listening to Spotlight on Broadway Radio. I'm your host, Jenna Tessa Fox. Today, we're putting the spotlight on Jessica Mulaski. Jessica has been performing on and off Broadway for decades. She's released 7 albums with her husband, John Pizzarelli. And as of recording time, she is ending her run in The Connector at MCC Theater. The Connector is a new musical by Jason Robert Brown and Jonathan Mark Sherman that feels very timely in an era of great mistrust in the news and the people who make the news. Jessica, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to talk with you again. So this is, your 100th show with Jason Robert Brown? Or your third, or somewhere in between there?
Well, I guess, I've been working with him on Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil for a couple of years. So that's, I worked with him on doing all the demos for the last 5 years as he was writing them. So yeah, I guess we could say 4 or 5 that I've had something to do with, besides the actual productions of course, the first original songs for New World and Parade at Lincoln Center and now The Connector, which has just been such a gift.
Amazing. Yes, I understand you were the first woman to sing Still Hurting from the last 5 years. I'd only learned that recently.
Yeah, he would call me and say, hey, I've got this idea to do this show backwards, like the two people, they only meet in the middle chronologically when they get married. And so he started with the ending and the beginning. And then worked his way in to the middle. So it was thrilling, basically learning it and singing it, in a bathroom or somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Recording it.
That sounds amazing. What has your working relationship been like over the years since you've worked together quite a few times?
Well, I have to say that this experience, The Connector, was singular in that Daisy Prince as well, who conceived and directed the piece so beautifully. I've known them for almost 30 years. So there was there wasn't any of that like, oh, I hope they like me, or, it's just that kind of like, it's just, you already know you're safe. And if they don't yell at you, you're fine. it's just like good friends working together. It's the most fertile and artistic experience of my life. It's like all the work I do with my husband, it's as my father-in-law used to say, you can't beat blood,
Yeah, definitely. And you've worked with both Hal and Daisy Prince over the years. Can you talk a bit about their directorial styles and what that was like working with father and daughter?
Well, Hal Prince was my absolute hero, because I had all those records, those Sondheim Prince records, in my basement in the bowels of Connecticut. And I swore that I was going to leave when I could get out and go work with Hal Prince. And I got to work with him twice. I think that I've had many feelings about how proud he would have been to see Daisy kind of continuing his kind of out-of-the-box work, especially from how political this is. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that Hal did had some sort of political meaning, including Sweeney Todd. And also there is one, I think, coup de théâtre at the end of The Connector that I think Hal would have just jumped over the moon about. Mm-hmm. They're both just really open-hearted, brilliant people. And they love to make theater. Who could ask for anything more, right?
Absolutely. And they're both highly acclaimed in the field. And speaking of Daisy Prince, I believe you first worked with her on Songs for a New World. And that was closing in on 30 years, which kind of blows my mind, honestly.
Yeah.
What is it like to see songs that you debuted in that show become standards for musical theater performers today?
Well, before, this could never happen today, this is hilarious, but before they actually hired me to do Songs for a New World, Jason said, hey, can you just come over to my house? And I just want to run, because I guess there was so much you know, character work. I had to do, you know, Marie, I'm out here, Marie, and just so many different kind of things. He wanted to make sure that I had it in me. But mostly what he did was play his songs for me. And when he played songs for Stars of the Moon for the first time, he was only 23. I said, when did you write that? He said, a couple of years ago. I said, who are you? You know, how did this 19-year-old kid sitting in his house in Muncie, New York, understand about a this disgruntled housewife who married the wrong guy, you know, middle-aged woman? It's just amazing. I always knew that there was something huge there. And also, you know, now doing the connector, I would say 5 young people, which is one of the wonderful things about the MCC Theater, is they make tickets available for young audiences. And to see these kids now, there's still only like 22, 23 who said that record changed their life, Songs for New World. It means so much to me. I can't tell you.
What was it like to develop that show back in 1995? So you already knew Jason before you began working on Songs for a New World?
Oh, no. I auditioned for him, and I auditioned for Daisy and for Jace, and they hired me. The only person I knew involved in it was Billy Porter. And when I say in six, I feel the same way about this particular production I'm in now, because it's Daisy. I'm still like daily friends with those people, all that cast. Brooks Manskis and I basically spent the entire, you know, COVID lockdown together. He's one of my dearest friends, and Andrea Burns. I feel very blessed. That was one of those things where you get in a room and you go, yeah, this is going to be really special.
Considering how much of the connector focuses on mentorship, do you feel like a mentor to those kids coming up and telling you how much that album meant to them?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you just never know. It's like me listening to Little Night Music. You just never know when something like that can spark a flame in someone and they can end up writing, you know, being the next Tony Kushner or the next, you know, whatever. And, and those things changed my life. So it makes me very happy. And we've just recorded the connector, and I think it's going to be sensational. So with any luck, we'll keep moving the ball forward to the next generation.
I certainly hope so. And speaking of standards, your cabaret and jazz career has been pretty fantastic over the last couple of years. You are a regular at the Carlisle and at Birdland. Can you talk a bit about transitioning from one stage to another and what that was like for you as a performer?
Well, the cabaret thing was just a blessing. I mean, 99% of it is because I'm married to a brilliant jazz musician who forced me to do it because I was terrified. I'd never been on stage as myself with just no costume, no wig, no whatever, just me. And it was really terrifying for me first. Well, it still continues to be in those really tiny, intimate rooms like the Carlisle, where, I mean, this year we're almost there 20 years every fall, which is incredible. But I think, you know, it also let me be a mom where I didn't have to do 8 shows a week. You know, I could kind of pick and choose when I was going to work. And also, frankly, you know, I was becoming a woman of a certain age, and there's just not that much representation for women of my age on Broadway anymore. Unless you have somebody, you're lucky enough to have someone like Jason Rambert around write you a part. Sorry about that. So it was just a gift. And also I think it's made my stage work better. Because you can't tell a lie in those small rooms. You can't, you know, you're so exposed. You really use any of the tricks. You just have to tell the story. And I think that just standing on those small stages, just telling the story with great musicians was really like going and getting, you know, my doctorate in a way.
And you talk a bit about how your cabaret work and performing on those small stages has changed you as an actress. You mentioned not being able to hide anything, but are there other ways that you feel you've evolved as an actress since you've become such a cabaret icon?
Well, you know, you have to so be in the moment in those cabaret situations because people are part of the action. You know, they're not just tacitly sitting there. Sometimes they talk, sometimes they drop their forks, sometimes they have opinions. You just never know what's going to get thrown at you. And so it just forces you to totally be in the moment. And also working with jazz musicians who are improvising constantly, they listen in such a heightened way. Because if someone plays a figure in an improv, then, you know, they listen to it and then they develop it. And that's really, really helped me, which is another wonderful thing about The Connector is it's the only musical I've ever been in where all the musicians have an opportunity to improvise during the score.
Really?
And so every night. Yeah. I mean, the song, The Western Wall has a huge, Cassandra has a huge section where it's all improvised. So every night is different and it keeps you really in it for that moment. And, it's really fun. Yeah. Jazz musicians listen in such an intense way that I think it helps me with my acting.
Fantastic. Did not know about the improvised moments. That is wonderful. See, this is why I need to go back and catch it one more time. Can you tell me how you got involved in the production? You said that Jason wrote this character for you.
I said that. I think, you know, I think he wrote it with me in mind, or a person like me in mind, a vocal, you know, the way I kind of break down material. It's just, you know, the song I have is absolutely exquisitely and insane. And yeah, so I think he did. It was one day years ago, Daisy called us and said, come over to my house. And she had some little noshes and she just started talking about the idea of this thing. This is now way before alternative facts, fake news, any of the people that coined those phrases, for like, I don't want to name any of them, happened, but it was just the idea that there were these isolated incidents like Stephen Glass, where they were supposedly, you know, doing nonfiction, and it turned out that it was a lot of gray area to it. And she said, I think there's something here that's important. I mean, she must have had a crystal ball, because now we don't know what is what, and we haven't even begun to look at AI yet, you know. But that's where it started. It was just the germ of it. And she writes some things, or they write some things, and we just sit around every once in a while and read them. And then we went to Vassar and a couple of other places to, you know, expand it. But the minute I started to hear the score, I was like, oh boy, here we go. I mean, Jason's not in any way, shape, or form, as far as I'm concerned, his talents have diminished with age.
Definitely not. And how would you say the show has taken shape since those early days and since you've been involved with it?
Well, it's the story has stories within the story, because it's about a writer. And so it fits Jason very well in terms of a Songs for a New World-esque storytelling, because those are all standalone story songs that he put together in sort of like a review. So there's the narrative of the actual piece and then the stories that come to life through music. And those have changed. One of them was about baseball, and now it's about Scrabble. And so he just kind of, you know, tweaked it along the way. But the actual storyline has been pretty much the same since the beginning.
It was about baseball originally. He could have done a baseball song. He already did basketball. And
it was a great baseball song, I think. And also this new incarnation, they added the element of the corporate world insinuating itself into the writer's world, which I think is really timely, because this the place takes place before the internet really hits, before now we know, you know, so many of these magazines have become like dinosaurs, you know.
Sure.
Mostly everybody gets their news online. And so the idea that they need a corporation to kind of bolster that. And then what does that mean? How does that affect the news when you have big money behind it? All those kind of things. I think that was an important addition in the most recent iteration.
One thing I really loved about the musical was the way it amplifies the voices of women and people of color who keep getting passed over and dismissed in favor of a white man. How did you feel about that angle of the story being in the forefront? I've heard that evolved gradually over different revisions. I'd love to hear how that facet of the story came into shape.
Well, there's a song called Cassandra.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the refrain is, half the stories in the world are not being told because we're not listening to women. And there was a lot of pushback actually from especially press about that feeling. A lot of them, frankly, were written by white men. But the idea, when you think about it, I mean, we still haven't had a female president of the United States. You know, it's not like this is passé information. That, you know, I feel it as an older woman, you know, the invisibility aspect, but the idea that what would the world be if all the stories were being told, and I think that's a fascinating and singular idea for a song.
Definitely. It's absolutely a highlight of the show. So how does it feel to create a character in an original musical again?
Oh, well, you know, it's my favorite thing in the world. I mean, the feeling of singing a song for the first time for the person who wrote it and adding your DNA to it is my favorite thing to do. You know, and I've been really lucky in that I've gotten to do some phenomenal revivals of shows like Sunday in the Park with George, or a beautiful production of Most Happy Fella that I did at Encores. But there's nothing like the tightrope walk that is just going out in front of an audience for the first time and not knowing, you know, if the tree falls in the forest, what kind of sound it's going to make. It's thrilling and terrifying. And then finding the way, you know, like having the guts to, as with the group of unbelievable people, to go out there and say, we don't know what it is, but tomorrow maybe it'll be something else, or we're going to throw the ball a different way and see. And the audience, you know, tells you. And I could feel over the course of whatever, how many weeks now we've been performing, the audience leaning further and further in. And, you know, it's just because you're telling the story more clearly.
Wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. I'd love to know, what moments do you find them leaning in on, and has that changed over the course of the run?
Well, the show starts to take a turn about three quarters of the way in, where people think they know what it is, but then it just starts to take a turn. And a lot of it is, as you say, is the female characters saying attention must be paid. Melinda Hall, who's brilliant, plays the role of the, you know, the woman who writes all the letters about all the everything, and then you realize towards the end of the show she's not crazy, she's actually right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the piece is about the inflection point. It's like, when do we get so far away from our center that we can't get back anymore? And it's the women who say, let's have zero tolerance on what we know, what is real, and we know what's not truth. And now, you know, we live in a time when someone says blue is red and everyone believes it.
Mm. Absolutely. So the production, as of recording time, is set to end its run at MCC this weekend. What is next for you?
I guess I can say this. Next I'm going to my sweet little lake house in Putnam County, and I'm going to put my feet up because I forgot how hard it is to do a brand new musical and then do it 8 times a week. It's hard. It is not for the faint of heart. But then in May, I'm going to go work on Jason's newest show, which is going to the Goodman, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is being written. He wrote with Taylor Mack, wonderful.
Yes.
Taylor Mack. And we're going to do it again, see what that is.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Oh, that's Wonderful news. Very excited. Well, now clearly I've got to hop on a train and come see that. And I also understand you've just re-released four of your albums digitally on Center Stage Records. How does it feel to revisit those classics and bring them out to a new generation?
It feels great. It's one of those things. I bought them back from the original company that they were with, and I took everything down off the internet. And I, being the elderly person that I am, couldn't quite figure out how I wanted to get them back up, because, you know, there's all kinds of considerations in publishing and stuff like that. And then John and my husband, John Pizzarelli, and I recorded a record for Stephen Pasquale, which was going to be the first record that the Center Stage Record company put out. And I said to them, and I knew Robbie Roselle, and I said, "Hey, I've got these sitting around in limbo. Will you want to put them out?" And they said, "Sure enough, yeah." And it means a lot because my father-in-law, Bucky Pizzarelli, is on those records.
Blessed memory. Yes.
Yes. Several wonderful, wonderful, wonderful jazz musicians who are no longer with us, who give such great. And so, yes. So I feel, as you say, their memory is a blessing, and it feels wonderful to have them be out there and having younger people find them. I'm proud of them.
Rightly so. Absolutely. I'm excited to hear them again. I've got the original CDs, and now I've got an excuse to download them one more time. Oh, Jessica, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing all these stories, and looking forward to seeing Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil coming up soon.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Jenna.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.